order. Welcome, and I apologize for starting a little bit late, but we were trying to get everyone here. No one has signed up for public hearing on House Bill 2691, so I'm going to go to a work session on House Bill 2691. I had a few comments I wanted to make. The focus of this committee has been to create jobs and to encourage the creation of new jobs. And we need to put Oregonians back to work. And House Bill 2691 does that. It's the beginning. With the closure of 180 mills in Oregon since 1989, we have lost good-paying jobs, and we must get serious about restoring these jobs. So whether it's 5 or 50 jobs, this is critical to this state. So we'll not be able to solve every problem facing the redevelopment of abandoned mills, but it will be a great first step. So I wanted to say that, and with that, I'm going to make a motion to move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2691. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I would like to make a motion to move House Bill 2691 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And Representative March.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I get your vote?
Let us hope that your foresight in elections is as good as it is in bringing forth this bill.
Oh, thank you.
I do want to state on the record, I think this is an excellent concept. I'm glad we have the opportunity to move and put some of these sites that had otherwise just sit there to use, and also in the particular case in Hood River County, I think is an excellent company to come in and do the kind of work they're doing. I know there will be some other people looking at it when it gets over to the other side, and just to make sure that all the language is tight and all the I's dotted and T's crossed and that sort of thing, but I certainly will support it to move it on to that process.
Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Representative
Richardson, yes.
I'd like to just mention that this is going to be a tremendous benefit to the Southern Oregon region, where we've had such a loss of income and jobs from closing off the forest to the timber industry, and to be able to utilize these sites that for many years have been commercial and in the forest products there, industry, and be able to have that be opened up so that other industry can be there will be extremely valuable to Southern Oregon. So we thank you for having the foresight to pass this through.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Well, we have a motion to move House Bill 2691 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Linda, will you call the roll?
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Pass?
Aye.
Representative
Hunt? Aye.
Representative
Marsh? Aye.
Representative Gerger?
Aye.
Representative
Gallego?
Aye.
And Chair Smith?
Aye. Having received the necessary votes to pass, I will move House Bill 2691 to the floor, and I will be the carrier of the bill. Surprise, surprise. It's a great day. Thank you very much, and thank you, Bill Fashing, for coming from Hood River today to see this. I know this is a big step for Hood River County, and I'm glad to help. Thank you. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2691.
Okay.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2298. Kim, do you want to bring us up on this one?
Sure, I certainly can. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2298 has been before you earlier for public hearing. There's been some discussions in the meantime, and today you're being presented with the -6 amendments to this bill, which is a combination of suggestions primarily from Representative Butler, Representative Greg Smith, and Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. The biggest thing that these amendments do, as was previously discussed, is removes any references to enterprise zone and contains the bill to only affect small business small city business development tax incentive, which is an income tax incentive for businesses that locate in some of the poorest areas of our state. There was some prior discussion about the number of employees required. These amendments continue the number at 5, as was in the original bill. I know we discussed changing that number back to 10 at one point. In addition, it changes the inclusion of ports per se and expands the possibility of the exemption to county industrially zoned lands. They may be included in a port, or they may be just outside of the UGB near one of these smaller cities. And it also brings the ports to the table in terms of being able to consider whether this is an appropriate income tax incentive to give to the business as it's being located, and requires the department to notify the ports, the cities, and the county where the business proposes to be located.
Okay. So I need a motion?
Yeah.
Which one? The chair needs a motion to move the Dash 6 amendments. Representative Berger?
Are we in work session?
Yes.
Okay. I move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2298 be adopted.
I have a motion to move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2298. Is there any discussion? Do you want to make any comments, Representative Smith, or are you just here to watch?
I'm just here to watch.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The Dash 6 amendments. Whoops. Do I? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I do. Get this right. Okay. Representative Berger?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2298 to the House Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation.
I have a motion to move the House Bill 2298 to Revenue with as amended. Is there any discussion? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was one that raised a lot of the questions about the number of employees, and after some discussion with the department, I think the appropriate way to handle this is to request that the committee request Ways and Means put a note in the department's budget so that they report back to us at the next session and tell us how this program's going and whether there's been any abuses or that sort of thing, and rather than trying to amend it, and I think that would be the most appropriate way. And
I think that's a good suggestion.
Thank you.
I think we could make sure that note gets on there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Objections? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hess? Representative Mark?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Niagara?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We move House Bill 2298 to Revenue.
Thank you.
We close the work session on House Bill 2298. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2671. And Kim, do you want to tell us about this bill?
Sure. Chair Smith, members of the committee, House Bill 2671 allows a business to claim the long-term non-urban enterprise zone property tax incentives if the total cost of a facility exceeds $200 million, has at least 20 full-time employees hired at an annual average wage of 150% of the county annual average wage, and the facility is located 10 or more miles from Interstate Highway 5. You also have in front of you the Dash 1 amendments, which would change the number of full-time employees required from 20 to 10.
Thank you, Kim. We also have in front of us Representative Garrard. Welcome to our committee. And I assume since you didn't sign up, these other people who did are with you.
Madam Chair, thank you. And this is Rob Trotta.
Okay.
Project manager, and Mr. Trey Sen, who is our economic development director in Sonoma County.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Zilberard from District 56, which is Klamath Falls and all of southern Klamath County, where this project will be located. House Bill 2671 is basically about incentive to help create a more positive business atmosphere in Oregon. It's what we've all been talking about for the past 2 months. What we're talking here is a long-term rural enterprise zone for this project. This project is basically the creation of a new power-generating plant in the small town of Bonanza, which is approximately 25 miles from Klamath Falls. Mr. Trotta and Mr. Sen, sitting to my right, have both worked extremely hard, and the People's Energy have done, up to this point, everything right. And I don't want to mess things up at this point for them. They have completed the application process. This is a environmentally very friendly, positive project. This is good for our particular area. These folks are ready to invest $700 million in the state of Oregon and the Klamath Basin in the creation of this plant. And I don't mean to take away any of your figures. Just repeating them, gentlemen. $800 million in union labor salaries, 457 trades and employees just in the construction of this project. And when it's done, as Ms. Mensford mentioned, at least 10 new jobs with an average wage for permanent employees of $82,000 annually. That's economic development. That's economic health for the Klamath Basin in particular. We happen to be located on what is, in essence, the flyway of electrical power for the entire western United States. And that's one of the reasons why it makes putting this plant in Klamath County attractive. But to make it happen, we need to step forward by supporting this bill and sending the message that we want economic development in the state of Oregon and that we're willing to provide the incentives to get business to come to Oregon and invest. With that, I will turn this over to either Mr. Trotta or Mr. Sen and be happy to answer any questions that the chair may have.
Representative Gallegos.
Representative Gerard, thank you for coming. And we both sit on the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. We recently had testimony about electrical companies. Can you just confirm who the electrical company is that's going to build the power generator? It's not affiliated. I just want confirmation with the other testimony we received and, you know, anything that's involved in the PGE, perhaps.
It has nothing to do with Portland General Electric. Doesn't have anything to do with Enron.
Okay. Thank you.
I just relieved your anxieties.
We're all feeling better.
Yeah. It might be quite some time in the future before People's Energy is ready to buy Portland GE.
Thank you.
We would always hold that option open, right?
Of course. And just to leave a little bit more light on that question. My name is Rob Trotta. I'm Director of Power Generation for People's Energy Resources Corp. And I am the project manager for the proposed Cobb Energy Facility. Cobb stands for California-Oregon Border. And to further address that question as to our relationship at all with any other utility within or load-serving entity within the Pacific Northwest, People's Energy is a 150-year-old natural gas company, basically, for Chicago and the surrounding areas. Within the past several years, we've gotten involved in merchant generation and have several facilities throughout the U.S. Throughout the turmoil in the energy industry that we've been experiencing the past several years, People's Energy has been able to maintain a stronger reputation as in doing good business, and in doing so has retained our investment grade rating throughout the market. So to address that fear as to who we are a little bit more. should I speak a little bit more?
Sure.
If I may?
Oh, you may.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to address you all. And I know that the long-term rural enterprise zone is really a state general type of concept for counties that qualify for this type of enterprise zone. I'd like to speak a little bit about it as it applies specifics, the specifics to a county, the specifics to the state, and the specifics to the labor force within the area. It's been now almost 2 years that I've been in your state developing this project, and I've been working with the Office of Energy and working with the county and working with a countless number of other state agencies and fellow agencies to go through the process. 2 years passed, and a lot of time and effort and resources. We're really getting past the point where I do just restate that all our applications have been submitted. We're to the point where we're ready to almost have a completeness determination. We are still going through the permitting process within the state. And it's very detailed, very detailed. It's a very detailed process. and we continue, but we're well at a point right now that we feel we are past the fatal flaws for this project. So now we look at it that I have one aspect, the permitting aspect of the project, which we're doing very well and feel very comfortable with. Then we say, okay, well, there's obviously some other pieces to the project. There's the economics and the market aspect of the project. And that's kind of where this bill 2671 comes into play. As you can see it through the bill and through the little short write-up, what we're really trying to do is make this make the project more economically viable. To put this in perspective, the overall investment of the project from our company is approximately $700 million. The economic benefit through the economic analysis, that impact analysis that we did within the county, meaning that we took away all the leakage. Obviously, you may not be purchasing turbines within the state. I mean, we did a very conservative type of study as to what the impact may be just within Klamath County. And the economic impact within Klamath County within the first 4 years, including construction and first 2 years of operation, was $469 million in direct and direct economic benefit just within the county. The facility will be, will employ over 457 tradesmen through the process of construction for over a 23-month construction cycle to build a facility like this. The facility will, and that is at a cost of over $80 million in payroll just for labor to build this facility. And as was stated earlier, is that it will employ, depending on who runs the facility, anywhere from 10 to 30 full-time employees. And the average salary with benefits and burdens is about $82,000 a year. It's not uncommon in other states that I've done projects like this to look for incentives to make these projects happen. States like Pennsylvania offer Keystone Opportunity Zones, where I've done a project and we were successful achieving one. That's a 15-year no state tax incentive. There's states out there like Missouri that do Chapter 100 financing. There's states out there like Illinois that do 10-year zones as well. So I think what we're looking to accomplish is something that you're not reinventing the wheel. It's just creating a standard or a criteria that this facility would then qualify for, and then aid in bringing that investment forward.
Great. Thank you.
That's all I had, unless there's any questions further about me, about the project, about the company. I know it's a little specific, but...
Well, Representative Richardson has a question. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Trotter, could you give us an idea of where these employees will be coming from?
Yes, I can. And I might ask, we have representation from the trades factor as well. The project has made a commitment to the Oregon trade unions that these facilities will be a union job. Now, as far as first offer or what those contracts or what those terms look like, they've yet to be established because an engineer procurement and construction firm has not been retained. But the project has committed to using Oregon First trade union labor.
Yes.
And
the 10 minimum jobs that will be long term, will those also be employed from Oregon's work pool or be brought in from other states?
It's kind of difficult at this time to be able to nail down these jobs that have very specific technical experience necessary. We always aim to try and retain people within the local communities for those types of jobs or within the state first. But because of the specific trades and skills that are necessary for it, it would be very difficult to commit as to where those employees would be coming from to start with. But it is, you cannot fly in or commute on a daily basis to this type of job, so they would become permanent residents of the area.
One final one.
Sure.
So we can rely on what you're saying, that when it's time to hire these permanent positions, that you will look within Oregon for qualified people before making a determination?
There's two aspects of how we actually go forward with that. First one is just it's good business, you know, and something that you like to tout, that you're looking to the community and the locals first, and that's just doing good business.
We think so.
And the second is what we call a labor survey. One of the requirements for the engineer procurement and construction company that is selected is to perform a labor survey within the local communities in the state to see what entities qualify for providing products and services for this type of facility. And that is literally a report that, once completed, I would have no problem sharing as who qualifies.
So the answer is yes?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
Representative Berger?
Madam Chair, Mr. Trotta, you said 10 to 30 full-time employees, and this statute speaks to 20 full-time by the end of the third calendar year, if I read this correctly.
That's amendment.
We haven't gotten to that.
Oh, yeah.
Can I speak to it?
Yeah.
Because I'm concerned that that is doable with this project.
That's
so how many employees are you talking about, I guess, is my question. And do you think you can do realistically?
Realistically, I have not had a chance to read the amendment before we get into it. Is to put in perspective of a project like this, is that we are being permitted to be 1,150 megawatt facility. The full-time employees of that facility would be anywhere from 20 to 25 employees. It is possible that, and not impossible, that number may come down depending on what area, who is hired to do it. If PacifiCorp is hired to run it, they might be able to more efficiently with some more local people. So it is questionable about what that. And I believe that the 10 should be a firm number. It's my understanding that the 10 would be a firm number from the start of operation forward.
Okay.
So a 20-year number after third year would cause me some angst, and I don't think it would question whether we'd be able to still qualify.
Thank you. Representative March?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Trotta, I didn't catch what kind of a generation facility. Is this a gas generation?
Yeah, it's one sole fuel, natural gas fired. And really, Klamath County is really located in a super highway of energy. Really is, and I've been familiar with that. I didn't make up the Cobb Energy Facility. You know, it was it is literally a trading hump for energy moving in the winter to Pacific Northwest and to California in the summer. And we're right around the corner from a Pacific Gas Transmission Bonanza compressor station. Sole fuel will be natural gas.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Trey Sen. Thank you for letting me speak also, Madam Chair. I'm the director of KCDA, Klamath County Economic Development Association, and I would like to just note that some 3 years ago we adopted as our goals and objectives, among several that we have, the possibility of power generation, because everyone was telling us that, you know, you've got the great crossroads between electrical capacity and the natural gas lines. During that time, we had several opportunities to work with other companies that were looking, and we very quickly came to the conclusion, and I think the correct one, that this was the company that we wanted to continue down the path with. They had the best track record. We did our due diligence. We worked with our partners in Oregon Economic Community Development. This is a fine company that has an outstanding record, and this will it will not make our day, it will make our year to have a company like this. It may make 2 years to have a company like this, especially in times of a recession, to be able to employ those who need to be employed the most and pay them good wages. And it certainly is an extra benefit to have the 10 to 20 permanent jobs after that. Thank you.
Great. Any questions, Representative March?
Yes. I'm actually back to Representative Berger's question. Is 10 the right number? I mean, or would 15 be sufficient after 3 years? Is that a? I mean, I just wonder where the number came from. So.
I went back to the team after speaking with Kim and going through the numbers again and looking at the facility, and I came back with the number that I knew that we wouldn't put the project in jeopardy of not qualifying was 10. And does it mean that it's going to be 10? No. Am I erring on the low side? Yes, I am, and I'm erring on the low side for a reason, because I want to make sure that this goes through in a manner that we would still qualify for. It would be, that's a number that's what I think is it really should be, and still be able to qualify, not put us in jeopardy if not. I don't know if I'm addressing your question.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative March, just to give you kind of a guideline, Mr. Senator, correct me if I'm a little off on the numbers, but we presently have already one cogeneration plant located in Klamath, and the second project already on the blueprint for another cogeneration plant right next to it. And I believe it would it's around the same type of output, megawatts-wise, and it employs, I believe, 22 people, just to give us a ballpark idea. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If you'd indulge me, Mr. Trotter, with one more question, because you clearly have had experience citing these kinds of facilities in other states.
Correct.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being difficult, 1 being easy, how would you put our permitting process?
At 11.
Thank you.
Good answer. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I'd just be curious if you actually had the numbers to deal with, once the construction up, clearly $800 million is a lot to have in your community, in jobs, and I'm sure it would be a big boost to the community. But once the construction project is gone and the 10 to 30 jobs are there, have you ever done any numbers to figure out for every dollar spent at this new salary rate what that also will generate out in the community in additional commerce?
Yeah. In the, I have to provide a copy of the economic impact analysis that was conducted, and we really took an extremely conservative approach with it. I don't know if you're all familiar with the term is leakage. It's like just because you have a $700 million investment, you don't spend $700 million in the state of Oregon or the county of Klamath. Our economic impact analysis was done at a very conservative, I want to say, $239 million investment. And then we did take that number as to all the ripple effect of what that meant through as people buy, you know, restaurants, wages, buying washers and dryers. So we did that out for 5 years. And that went over, I believe, to the extent of over $511 million in the first 5 years of the project, including construction, just within the county. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
And that's with the investing 235 generated 500 million. Okay. It was almost a 2-to-1.
Yes, and that is a conservative multiplier.
I would suggest that's a very conservative multiplier. That's considerably down from anything we usually use 10. $10 for every $1 generated spent 10 times.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Well, thank you very much. Great proposal.
Thank you.
Andrew, is it Studley?
Yeah.
Great.
My name is Andrew Studley, and I'm representing the Klamath and Lake County Economic Development District, and I'll be very brief, of course. Aside from being a significant positive impact, economic impact to the region, I'd like to reiterate what Mr. Sen said, that it is power generation is a priority in our area. And I also think that it shows the ability for economic diversification and some challenging times within our region right now, and so I think this is a very positive project to our Klamath and Lake County region. Thank you.
Great, that was great. Are there any questions?
They took all my words.
They took your thunder, didn't they?
Well, thank you. I just wanted to add on the record that Senator Harper came in and said he was very supportive of this, too, and I wanted that to be part of the record. So he couldn't be here, but Justin. Is there anybody else here that wants to testify on 2671? Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Shiprock, representing the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council in support of this measure as well. I've worked with Mr. Trotta. We are currently in the building trade suffering approximately a 25% unemployment rate here in Oregon, depending on what craft and what part of the state you're in. This would provide some badly needed jobs for the trades, and it's a well-thought-out project. I am an electrician by trade and have some understanding of megawatts and distribution and transmission and all these issues, and involved in a number of these types of projects around the state as well, and so we're here to support this as well.
Great, thank you.
Provide a lot of jobs down in there in Southern Oregon.
That's certainly will. Are there any questions, Bob? Oh, Representative Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Berger asked a great question earlier. It may have been before you came in, talking about lessons we can learn from this project in terms of some of the difficulties around the state's permitting processes.
Mm-hmm.
What are some lessons, based on your experience with this, that we might be able to learn in terms of how we can do projects, how we can encourage projects like this that really seem to have brought together business and building trades in a way that creates such a great win-win? Any lessons for us to learn from that?
It's, and Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the state continues to make some progress in streamlining the permit process for these plants. There needs to be more work done in that area. And I've had personal thoughts, perhaps you have a team representing the various state agencies that would look at these types of projects that are experienced in state and federal requirements, that basically that's what they do, and very expert type of people that would help expedite these projects. One of the problems you have, however, that I've witnessed, the energy situation right now is so up in the air. We've had people that have come in and frankly wasted the state's time going through the permit process because they don't have the money to build these. If you were here last session, I was thinking, boy, full employment. Everybody's going to be building powerhouses. We haven't done one. So you've also got that problem. And I think maybe one of the other things that you can do is look at what are real projects. What is the chances that this is a real thing? Or is it just somebody submitting an application basically as a placeholder? And some of that's went on. But in Mr. Trotta's case, he's got millions of dollars invested. I don't think he's here just to entertain the bureaucracy, if you might say. They'd like to build this. Power sales contracts right now are very cloudy. We all know what the situation is with BPA. I hope I've answered your question. I just see a better relationship between the state and federal agencies on citing these. And they can ask the tough questions, and they should. And frankly, there's no reason to sacrifice environmental laws or anything else. You don't have to do that. Use best available technology and everything else. And that'd be my only recommendation that I can see from my perspective, and I've been involved in it somewhat, and that's what I see.
Okay, can I just ask one follow-up? In terms of the relationship that you all have clearly established, Mr. Trotta and his investors and your counsel, I mean, any lessons learned specifically in terms of how that kind of keeping the good jobs here, mm-hmm. keeping your folks, maybe not fully employed, but more employed?
Excellent question. And Chair, I'll be real frank with the committee. We've had a situation in Oregon, in the Umatilla area, where a developer made some promises to the county up there, Umatilla County. The commissioner was here last session testifying, where 85% of the construction workforce was brought in from out of state. It had never happened in Oregon before, never. And it obviously infuriated me. And when I've got all these people very qualified, they've got past experience in that part of the state in building these things, and then to have majority of the workforce, and I'm not talking California, Washington, Idaho, I'm talking Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas. So one of the things we try and do is work with, one, the local government, because they're not inviting these people in to have jobs imported, obviously, particularly in Klamath County. We talk to the developers. We tell them we have something to offer and assist them. But the bottom line is that these jobs would be, you know, local hire first. You know, you're not going to have 100 licensed boilermakers in Klamath Falls, but you can certainly use them first and then draw from other parts of the state, which is not a problem. It's routinely done, but we try and work as a team to try and get the project built and work on the aspects, the social aspects, of, if you will, of local hiring. And along with that, which is also very important, we have apprenticeship requirements. I mean, we train our young people on projects like this so that we have a trained workforce as well. It's very important. So there's something there for the community. As well, in rural areas, we start young tradespeople on projects like this, actually take young people who want to enter the building trades and get them out on that job. So we're trying to contribute to the community in that way, too, because we need skilled workers in every part of the state, not just Portland, every part of the state. It's critical to us, and we want to enhance that. That's what we do.
Great. Thank you. Representative
Gray? I just want to follow up on that, because I don't know whether I have a question or a comment, being that as we draw from other parts of the state to the possibility to, after we've exhausted the local market, it's my understanding, you know, it's the big construction project in the metro area in Washington County is the Intel project. My understanding, that's about wound up.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's wound up, there are no big construction jobs up here. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're absolutely correct. I said we're at 25%. I hope maybe I didn't say and growing. We are really concerned about my industry, frankly, because there's not a lot out there. We were buoyed for some time by there was a lot of school construction. The voters approved almost, well, add $1 billion worth of capital construction. None of that goes into the classroom. But we had school projects all over the state. Unfortunately, they're now winding down as well. So, yeah, we're, as an industry, we're sitting back going, what's next? You're absolutely correct.
Do you know what the timeline is for that to wrap up? I think it's shortly, right? And we'll see a huge jump.
They've been doing the tool installing now for about 8 months. It's got to be very close to being finished. And we had 3,000 people out there at the peak, and it's down to very few now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. Shipley? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Great testimony. Seeing no one else, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2671. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2671.
And Madam Chair?
Yes?
I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2671.
Thank you, Representative March. Representative March has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2671. Any discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Berger?
Is that the...
That's the dash... Yeah. Tim,
can you have the change to insert 10? Okay, yeah, I'm comfortable with that. Yeah.
You're comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought we were going the other way.
Any other discussion? Seeing no objection, we'll approve the Dash One amendments. I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2671 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, or does it have
a separate? It has a revenue.
Okay, I move House Bill 2671 to revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March has moved House Bill 2671 as amended to revenue with a due pass recommendation. Do you see any discussion? Linda, you want to call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. Gee, let me think about this. Motion carries. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2671, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Kim, you want to bring us up to speed? We've already had one public hearing, correct?
Sure.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2300, we had a public hearing on this about a week ago. We started, I think Mike Burton from Oregon Economic and Community Development started to explain the provisions of this bill to us, and I'll actually let him just continue.
You go ahead.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me back again. You may recall from the last time I was here that we're discussing what the department refers to as the omnibus or technical corrections bill, kind of where we put lessons learned and proposed adjustments to various programs we operate. So this bill kind of represents the range of activities the department undertakes, except for the tax incentive stuff that you've been talking about lately. There are also some other things that aren't here, but I'll get to it. Last time we started in, talked about a change in the purpose related to telecommunications, and then talked about small business development centers. I skipped over Section 2, so I thought I'd start in today with Section 2 on page 3, and specifically lines 27 through 24. This is a provision that is requested by the department's bond council because the department finances public infrastructure, community infrastructure, in a large way by selling markets. And this is consistent with clauses in two other parts of the statute. But essentially, because of tax limitations passed by a number of voter initiatives in certain parts of the country, bond council wants to make sure that the measures being funded, the projects being funded through bond sales, are legal, and are proposing this amendment to give us a blanket authority to go ahead with bond sales, independent of charter or other issues.
Can I just clarify? You said we're talking about Section 2, House Bill 2300, Section 2, on page 3.
Yes.
And I'm looking at stuff about water, safe drinking water.
Yes.
The revolving loan fund. The revolving loan fund is the bond issue that we're talking about?
Chair Gallegos, the revolving loan fund is one of the programs that we use to fund community infrastructure. The bond program is one of the mechanisms we use within that and other programs. So the department finds projects that are eligible for, in this case, safe drinking water, and then sells bonds to generate the resources to make loans. So this authority relates to bond council's request for clear authority to use bonds as a financing mechanism, in this case for the safe drinking water program.
Okay. You kept talking about the bond program, and I was just seeing a drinking water revolving loan fund. So. And the chair has shifted that correctly.
Chair Smith.
Can't trust her with a gavel.
I just didn't have a chance to found it yet. So.
The next several sections identified, I skipped over Section 3 there. I was about to skip over Section 3. Also on page 2, Section 3 codifies right at the bottom of the page 45 codifies those changes and make them part of law. The next several sections were covered on whatever day that was here. I think it was Friday last week. Whatever. So I'm going to skip ahead to the third page of my notes and section 8, page 6 in the bill. This is a change that the department's proposing because the department has been convening a quarterly meeting of representatives of the Oregon courts. One of the responsibilities of the department is to represent courts' interests legislatively and also financially. There was a work group constituted in law that was mandated and primarily was targeted toward the issue of maintenance dredging on Oregon shallow draft courts. That group has elected not to meet because we're not dealing with any new developments in that issue. The department has instead invited all 23 ports to meet with the department on a quarterly basis. The ports like that approach better. They feel that more of them are at the table. They feel that they're more represented. So we're proposing that we replace the old Oregon Ports Advisory Committee or Advisory Council with this new group we've created, and we're committed to bringing this group to meetings with the department on a regular basis. It becomes an advisory body of the department, so it becomes subject to formal public meeting laws, and that's why even though we intend to meet the group quarterly, we have to have quorums, and we will have to have quorums and the like, so I'm not sure we'll get a quorum to every meeting, so we're suggesting that they won't have to happen every quarter, but it is our intention to do that. So the ports are supportive of this. Representatives of the ports are in the back of the room, and I'm sure if you were interested, they would come forward and report this.
Do they want to come now?
Yeah,
sure. Sure. Yeah, before we go to a different section.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Public Ports Association and also the Oregon Ports Group. I had signed up, I think, third on your list to come up and testify, essentially just to communicate to you that that Oregon's 23 ports support what's being done here, not just the changes relative to the current Ports Advisory Council and what is being proposed here as the Ports Representation Group, but also some of the other sections that I'm sure Mr. Burton is going to talk about that deal with the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. All of the changes that are here in this bill represent either very important technical housekeeping corrections or some other significant program changes that really help us do a better job in conducting job creation, economic development activities. So wanted to let you know that we were on board with everything that's here and with what Mike is presenting.
Right. Do we have any questions at this time? No.
Madam Chair, maybe I should run through the rest of the ports issues.
Sure.
And invite Mr. Armstrong to
sure.
sit at the table. Or,
okay.
Given that the ports strongly support everything we're doing, and we can talk
about it.
Okay, I'll get back.
All right.
On pages 6, 7, and 8, sections 9 and 10 continue the same changes. Again, bringing together the larger, more representative group of ports. On section 11, there is a substantive change. That's on page 8, lines 5 through 25. The statute has historically made a distinction in the kinds of activities ports can undertake. Elsewhere, there's language related to the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, which then refers to those activities that ports might undertake. We've discovered over time that those aren't entirely consistent. So we're proposing to take out specific reference to port development projects and port and business development projects. These are all relative to ports activities. And instead, allow the department to use the Oregon Port Revolving Fund to fund any activity lawful for ports to undertake. So we get rid of this arbitrary distinction between these various segments of what the ports can do. Moving to section 12, also on page 8, there are currently in statute three limitations on amounts the ports can borrow from the Port Revolving Fund. There's an annual limitation, There's a per-project limitation, and there's a total limitation. The department is proposing that we collapse those into one limitation, which is a total debt limitation, or debt to the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. And because of inflation over the 10 or 15 years that the law has been in place, we're proposing to raise that debt limit from $2 million to $3 million. But getting past the limitations on per project or annual, and just going to the total debt limitation on any given port. Similarly, sections 13 and 14 address the same question. There is, I forget which one of those sections it is, but there is a cap on the interest rate, or there's a floor on the interest rates the department may charge ports that only applies to the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. Ports are also eligible as a public entity in Oregon to apply for assistance through our other infrastructure programs, which aren't subject to the same interest rate restriction. So the department proposes to eliminate the Oregon Port Revolving Fund interest rate restriction and use what we actually used, a rate that's indexed to bond rates and is published on a quarterly, adjusted on a quarterly basis. So we're proposing that we would use the same interest rates that we do with our other programs for all port activities, and not right now the rate, the floor on the Port Revolving Fund rate is higher than the market would demand. So the ports are, to use that resource, are paying a penalty, and we'd like to move to a market-based rate. So the change proposed here is to get it back. Turning the page, there's one, before Mr. Armstrong leaves, there's one more port-related issue buried in the back of this. There are two, actually. Sections 44 and 45 on pages 26. Both of which relate to a program, or both of which relate to a program called the Port Planning and Marketing Fund. The department is allowed by law to take a percentage of the resource in the Oregon Port Revolving Fund and use that to fund, make grants for ports to do planning or marketing projects. The current cap is 1.5% of the fund value. That's producing an annual dedication to the Oregon Port Planning and Marketing Fund of about $200,000. That's substantially below the demand. We've been at the cap on the program for several months now, and it's based on a fiscal year calendar, so we ran out of money halfway through the year. There's a lot more resource. The department proposes to change the cap so that instead of fixing it at a given percentage, the department would pledge to the legislature that we will not take more money out of the fund than the fund generates in income in a given year. So the amount that we could use for port planning and marketing would then be based on interest earnings of the fund, such that the fund will be managed to be sustainable in lieu of this fixed cap. The other change is in Section 45, and that is that there is a sunset on the Oregon Port Revolving Fund such that the program would end at the end of this fiscal year. Given that there's significant demand, given that it's a resource for ports to do planning work in anticipation of project, the department would propose that the sunset be removed. And those are the ports related issues. I think I'll pause here in case any of you have questions of either of us.
Representative Richards.
Madam Chair, Mr. Burton, the idea of the sunset, of course, is to help make sure that things get looked at periodically to assure that they don't just go on in perpetuity. And so generally speaking, I feel that sunsets are a reasonable thing to put in. Is there a reason why you're recommending that it be repealed completely rather than extended for another 5 years or some period of time?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, we'd be happy with an extension of the sunset. It's been a successful program that's been around I don't know how long. And we're happy to come back and make the request. We're not sure it's really necessary. This is a good program, and as long as the Oregon Port Planning or Oregon Port Revolving Fund's in place, it's our expectation that there will be demand for this sort of activity. But a 5-year extension of the sunset would be fine with the department.
Madam Chair, if I might also respond to that, and Representative Richardson, we have for several sessions and various times extended the sunset on that piece of it. I don't think you would find us having any great deal of heartburn over simply extending the sunset, but I would want the committee to be aware that this is to be specific, the sunset is on the transfer of the interest from the revolving fund into the port planning and marketing program. So that ends up being that approximate $200,000 figure. It's not accessible to anyone but the ports from a fund that is accessible only to ports, and it is a tremendous tool for ports to be able to go out, partner with the state in developing site development plans, some very intensive marketing studies to determine how best to expand the local economic base and that sort of thing. So it's a critical program. We just felt like it probably might be the best use of the legislature's time to remove that sunset entirely, since there really wasn't as much of an oversight issue there. But we certainly defer to the committee's preference on that issue.
Any other questions? Don't see any.
Chair Smith, that's the extent of the court's specific issues. I will go back now to page 10 in section 15, where I forgot the other day to cover one of the Small Business Development Center related questions, because it's out of order. But I'll go back and visit that now. I talked about this last time in the context of funding resources on the community college network. But essentially, the Small Business Development Center funding mechanism has been directed statutorily to community colleges and in three or four exceptions, state universities where there's not a community college to deliver the service. Given the pressure on community college budgets that's developing and a question as to whether or not they'll be able to continue what they consider to be not a mission central function, business counseling versus teaching kids, we're asking for the option that should it become necessary, we'd be allowed to contract with other service providers, through most likely for a fit-for-fit process. But we're concerned about the impact on community college funding to what we consider to be an important small business development tool.
Representative
Gallegos?
Well, I'm just initially alarmed at that because clearly higher ed funding, we've had lots of debates, there's lots of proposals, and to provide then a second funding mechanism, how would you as a grant program for community colleges, maybe if you could give me a little more, I would hate to set up a little mini legislature to go to four-year higher ed funding as the appropriate means of coming to the state legislature.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, I should probably back up and revisit the background related to small business development centers. There are 21 small business development centers scattered around the state, all but three or four. I can think of three state universities that deliver small business development center services, but I think there might be a fourth. Are located at and largely funded by community colleges. Approximately 50% of the funding for this business counseling services is provided by each of the local service providers. The other half is roughly divided between our department, our agency, and the Federal Small Business Administration. So the law was intended to make sure that we don't create a new service delivery mechanism for this business counseling service. The current state of community college funding is that it's contracting, and that community colleges are being forced to look at some of the services they provide to the extent that two community colleges have discontinued their small business development center efforts. The department responded to that in two ways. First, we proposed a program option package that would have provided through this agency, through an economic development funding, enough money to offset the expected loss to the community college system. That program option package did not go forward. And the other mechanism we sought was if we lose a delivery mechanism because the community college is forced to stop providing this service, we would like the opportunity to find a different service provider. It could be another community college, but for the most part, they're not willing to step outside of their taxing districts because they feel that they're being paid by the taxpayers to deliver services in the tax district. So it may be that we contact with a provider such as the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs or the Oregon Native American Business Entrepreneurial Network. Other service providers doing this kind of stuff. We're not talking about an alternate funding source for community colleges or four-year universities. We're talking about funding to continue this particular effort.
Of the small business.
Business Development Center.
I think my concern is this gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, this is a huge bill, really, when you think about all the different subject matter that it really covers, from ports, now community colleges, and certainly all in the realm of economic development. But we keep going, I get a little bit more alarmed as just the huge encompassing and the broad nature of things that are in there. And we're putting a lot of responsibility in OECDD and their funding mechanism and their areas of responsibility, and that's just kind of where my alarm keeps getting up.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, I appreciate your concern. In the department, there's concern about trying. It's often stated as trying to be all things to all people. From my perspective, it's much simpler than that. The department is about facilitating the growth of business and the creation of economic opportunity, whether that's jobs or self-employment or whatever it is. If we look at ways the state can facilitate economic activity or remove barriers to economic activity, while that can mean a lot of things based on the circumstances of the community we're working in, it makes it a fairly simple target. If the test is this going to make it better for the opportunity to create jobs or other economic opportunity, I think it's a fairly simple target. I think this is a very important program because many people know their business, whether they're I grew up in a restaurant, so I know about restaurants. Cabinet shops are another example I use all the time. There are people who know those businesses but don't know business with a capital B. And they may know how to deliver a dinner to someone's plate, but they don't necessarily know about cash flow and payroll and keeping the doors open in the winter and all that stuff. This program addresses that. This is, I think, a powerful tool and an important part of the state's support for job creation and business environment out there. And we're looking for ways to keep the base covered.
Just clarify that this program is the community college one in Section 15. You're not saying this program being all of 2300.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos. I'm specifically talking about the Small Business Development Center program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative March?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share my colleague's concern, in particular with the community colleges districts and the language contained herein. You have a very broad phrase here. If community college district is unable to adequately provide services in a specific geographic area, well, who determines that? I mean, in the case of you talking about the two community colleges discontinuing it, it's very clear. So if you'd said here, if the community college declines to provide it or a state university declines to provide it, then you contract with someone else, and I'd prefer to see something in there about a nonprofit myself. It would be better language. But as written, you could take some of your existing small business development programs and say, well, you guys are doing a pretty fair job, but you're not adequate in this geographic area, and we're discontinuing the contract. So you see what I mean? The language is overly vague.
Chair Smith, Representative March, I'd be happy to consider alternative language. The mechanism the department will use, intends to use, let me say, given permission, would be to list the services required, list the qualifications required, and issue a request for proposals, and see who's interested in providing the service in a very specific given area. We tried to get at that. You know, it talks about community college districts, community college service district. State university is broader than that, and they basically fill the gaps. The ones that come to mind are Eastern, Southern Oregon University, and Oregon Institute of Technology. But they sort of, the way it's been defined in the Small Business Development Center network is they fill the places that the community colleges aren't filling. They all essentially have statewide scope, but they're mm-hmm. they're serving a very right. definite service territory. So our expectation is to replace the missing link in our service delivery network with a specific provider. We'd love to see the current status quo continue. We're just concerned that it might not be possible. It is our intention to focus the service on specific areas.
And to go to only to go to contract to RFPs or RFQs in the case of where an existing small business development center has declined to provide those services?
Chair, Smith, Representative Mark, absolutely.
Okay, well, that's not what it says here. But I know, it may be your intent, but it's not what it says there.
Chair Smith, Representative March, the critical language, I think, is in line 10, is unable to adequately provide services in a specific geographic area, is what we're trying to get at there. I'm open to other language, so maybe we should take another run at it and get it back to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah. In light of this, it would be nice when we come back and look at this again if the community colleges would stop by and tell us what this looks like from their end.
Representative Berger, I'm sure that could be arranged.
I'm sure
we can probably get help in it.
Thank you. Representative Richardson, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, Mr. Burton, could you tell us where there's a definition for service providers? Because when it says that the department may make grants available to other service providers as determined by the department, that is somewhat vague. So I'm wondering, is there any limit to that?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I don't believe we intended to limit that. I don't think buried somewhere else in here is a definition. And as I suggested, it was our intention that if we couldn't deliver the services through our existing providers, that we'd issue an RFP and respond to who came in the door. Would there be a set of potential providers that would appeal to the committee?
I think that the concern is it's such a huge allocation of power that, and there's no accountability for it. We don't know, you know, we're the committee, and we don't know what OECD really does. We're just trying to find out, and this bill is a kind of an omnibus bill dealing with many, many areas, and just one little line of it says, and if we don't have the ability to do this through the normal channels, we'll find others and just give us the authority to do that. And so I'm new to this operation, but it just seems to be somewhat broad, and I don't know the solution, and maybe you could help me understand how is there accountability for how the funds are spent and so forth.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. I believe the department does a good job. And we've tried.
I said I'm not criticizing that. Okay.
I'm just looking for an opportunity to say that.
This isn't it.
So last time I was here, I brought in an annual report. And we talked specifically about accountability measures related to small business development centers. I would be happy to deliver to you the recent report on performance of the small business development. We are currently making payments on small business development center services based on performance. They deliver outcomes, we make payment. And I'd be happy to bring either the contract in or the report. We've done a survey to document the validity of or the results, efficacy of that effort, and I'd be happy to bring forward that information. It is summarized in here, lumped in with everything else. But we are covering that base very carefully.
Are you going to, yeah, would that work if he provided you with that information?
Well, I have no reason to doubt that it's, that information is going to show that there's some results from it. All I'm saying is that this is a tremendous leap of faith, and I haven't been here long enough to know if it's justified or not justified, and so I don't really have anything specific to request. I'll go back and look at that portion of the brochure.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Smith and Representative Richardson, we actually have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow, and I will be happy to bring, I've scheduled it with your office, I'll be happy to bring with me the Small Business Development Center performance information.
Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you. Representative
Gage. I think I've seen that. You know, the small business folks have did a great job coming around. I don't think that I have a question, and I don't think anybody's really expressing a concern about their performance. I think it really has, my questions have to do with Section 15 and just how broad that this perhaps could be interpreted to really go beyond what if there's an inadequate number of people, you know, wanting nursing studies, and, you know, at some broad point, I mean, that's really a jump, but that there's a huge broad leap here with the extent of what is needed, because I just don't see where it's that narrow and specific and asking for some accountability and that it's specifically, you know, just with respect to only small business centers. I think there's some broad language here. And
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, I would refer you to lines 8 and 9. Starting in the middle of line 8, it's the statute directs us to assist in the formation, improvement, and operation of small business development centers. We're not proposing to change that.
Could we get a little bit more narrow? I mean, and I think you've already said that you're willing to look at helping with some of the wording, and I think that's kind of... I'd like to be on record as not really having anything in opposition to the small business development centers. They've done a great job coming around the Capitol, letting us know what a great job they're doing. So,
Mr. Burton, do you have a meeting with her, too?
It does, as a matter of fact, I think. It's good. But you don't need to bring copies of that report. I have, I think, copies.
As Representative Gallegos, I don't have my calendar, but if I don't have one, I'll make sure I do.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Lots, I'm sure, but since you're going to be seeing us all.
There's members of the committee. We're entering the home stretch, and I think the most substantive part of the bill. And I'm going to give you a little history here. Yeah.
She's scared now.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a little bit of history here. When the department started using state resources to make investments in community capital projects, specifically it invested in infrastructure. And infrastructure was defined by a list of potential uses, ports, facilities, water, sewer, roads, airport facilities, and the like. The program that was created for that was a job development program called the Special Public Works Fund. And the statute referred to infrastructure generally. Over time, additional programs have been created. We talked briefly about the Safe Drinking Water Program. There's a program called the Water Fund in statute, which allows the department to invest in water and wastewater systems that are out of compliance. And most recently, in the last... it was in the 99 legislative session. The legislature gave the department authority to provide a finance vehicle for community facilities, which are, for the most part, buildings or structures that communities might undertake. They have to be municipally owned, and they have to be debt financeable. There are no grants allowed for community facilities as narrowly defined. But the statute continued to say infrastructure. Grants are allowed for infrastructure. They were not allowed for community facilities. So the next several pages of the bill are about separating out those two things and making it clear that, except in some limited cases in response to emergencies, federally declared emergencies, the department will not make grants for community facilities, but given financial assessment and demonstration of need, can make grants for infrastructure. So there are a series of changes on the next 10 pages or so that are all about separating out the broader definition of infrastructure and making it narrow and community facilities for the purpose of segregating out that grant capacity. And I'd be happy to walk through those, but most of the rest of this is about that. There are some other things scattered around in here, and I'll touch on those.
Does anybody have any questions on this portion of it?
I do.
Representative Gallegos.
And it's been brought up from some of the other private groups who are wanting to, you know, be focused on the economy, business leaders and stuff, who commented that Oregon Economic Community Development needs to get the community development out of the economic development. And so I think you've just confirmed there that the huge portion of OECDD is, or at least in 2300 here, is a significant amount of it in community development. And I'd just like to hear, it's a concern, because that's what many of the folks who are wanting to see economic development, that building communities and hoping something will come, as opposed to as a leverage item for something that will come, you know, when there's an investment in money, you know, almost there, we just put a couple things together.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, I would love to speak. We're actually planning on getting into the uses of our investments when we got to Ways and Means, but I can touch on it here, and we can get into as much depth as you'd like. But the department, as I mentioned, community capital investment through a federal program called the Community Development Block Grant, which the department still administers, mostly because without the department in the middle, the department gets an annual entitlement from the feds. Without the department in the middle, large entitlement communities, they're called, over 50,000, get a direct allocation from the feds. But the rest of Oregon had to compete and got no money. So the department got into that environment. It's fairly broad. We still have authority to do that. And we're starting to focus that resource more toward economic development. It's not intended to do economic development, but the department, the state, can add restrictions to the federal ones and narrow the focus. The state got into using state resources through the Special Public Works Fund, which is targeted toward job creation until the Community Facilities Authority was created in 99. 25% of the department's community capital investments are for economic development, have been over the last two biennium, this biennium and the last one. I manage the people who do this, and I track this on a fairly close basis. 50% of the department's investments over that time period in this area were for public water and sewer systems to address compliance issues. In my view, that's long-term economic development. If a community doesn't have adequate water or sewer, it can't host economic opportunity, economic expansion as they arise. And I would point out the semiconductor boom of the 90s as a case in point. Without millions of gallons of water available, primarily in the Portland area, but also in Eugene, lots of cheap energy and land, those developments would not have taken place. Much of Oregon, particularly small rural communities, are in a place where they have old systems that are falling down, that no longer meet standards. The mill that used to pay all the bills is gone. And for them to turn things around, for them to have a hope to rebuild the future, that fundamental base level infrastructure has to be there. The community facilities stuff is really, from my perspective, does two things. It's a service we deliver to our customers, that set of our customers that's communities. They need a mechanism to get there. We only make loans or use the federal resource. But it also, I mentioned the bond bank earlier, and this could get way complicated, but the department takes essentially $1 of state money, matches it, or takes a bunch of projects together, most of which wouldn't be bondable on their own, and takes with those non-bondable projects something usually from Portland or Eugene or a larger jurisdiction, puts them in a bundle and puts it on the market. We generate about $4 of on-market money for each state dollar we put forward, so we generate four times the activity of as the state resource comes into it. But to make the premise work, we have to have good, high-quality credit risks, or the bond market won't buy a project in, or should I pick on Hood River or someplace like that. You know, but to make it work, we're going to have to do some community facilities. They shouldn't be ever be part of our active project development. We should be responsive in that, but we need them in this program. And so I think there's reasons why we have to have a mix. Having said that, the department has been moving toward near-term job creation, focusing on economic development for over a year because the economy's been in the toilet for a while. And of the projects of this nature currently in the hopper, in an application stage or with an application being developed, 40% of them are economic development projects. So I think we're getting where you want us to go. And I think part of that is because times have changed. Last time I was speaking to the legislature, your counterpart from your district told me that we didn't need to do economic development in your district.
My counterpart.
Your predecessor.
I don't know who that is.
Thank you. We were given explicit instructions to stay out of your...
And do I look like him?
No.
Well, I hope not.
I hope that you'll continue the effort to cover the base and build the foundation that drives the Oregon economy. I think we need to do more of that. But I do think we need to focus on jobs as an outcome of that.
Thank you.
Okay. In Section 16, there's another piece that besides the community facilities infrastructure plan. The department is being increasingly called upon to finance storm drainage systems because, particularly in Western Oregon, it's a problem when it rains. So we would be adding that as a permitted use under infrastructure. Sections 17 through 20 on page 14 and 15 are about clarifying.
Mr. Burton, she has another. Representative Gallegos has a very short question. And we need to move on because we have other people who want to touch.
And I'm actually looking at your wonderful reports that I do have here and looking in the community system programs and infrastructure programs. Under what fund is the storm drainage systems, and is this all contained within the infrastructure programs, these type of things that are in these sections?
Sheriff Smith, Representative Gallegos. What this part of the statute does specifically would make it clear that storm drainage systems are an infrastructure project and could be funded using Special Public Works Fund or the Water Fund.
And I'm just Section 16 and on, all those things are actually these infrastructure programs that are in this report.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm
saying? Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, sections seven. Most of these are simply the infrastructure community facilities, so I'll gloss through that. But there are a few things that are not about that. I mentioned that we make on section 17 through 20 is the place where we clarify grants for infrastructure, loans for community facilities, except in the cases of federally declared emergency where a local match has to be generated for the community facility. That's the case where we use state resources for community facilities. In section 21, there's a piece I'd like to draw your attention to, and specifically we're taking out a reference to the community facilities account within the Special Public Works Fund. This is a result of the shift in the department's funding to a perpetual revolving loan fund model based on lottery bonds. But I mentioned that we have new authority with Special Public Works Community Facilities. We have old authority with Special Public Works Infrastructure. The new authority created a special account for the community facilities money. As we fund money projects in the near term, the community facility stuff would have to go into that account. Since we're at this point managing a large revolving loan fund that we need to be able to use as demand shifts into the future, we're asking that the distinction within the Special Public Works Fund be dropped and that the department be allowed to use the money to address economic development issues when those are or infrastructure issues when those are paramount, and if things change, that we be not bound by this narrow construct that, from our purpose, doesn't accomplish any particular need. I'm going to skip ahead to section 23 on page 15, which essentially, at the very bottom of the page, line 45, specifies pieces of the submissions that the department would receive to consider a project. We would just like to consider everything that we have on the community instead of specifically a feasibility study and an application. So we're taking out those two specific references. We're proposing that anyway, and asking that we be allowed to consider everything we have from the jurisdiction, whether it's a feasibility or something else.
Madam Chair, I just don't see it. Is that not something new that's being proposed?
It's
page 16, line 45.
15 on the bottom.
Yeah.
15, last line, 45, and ending on page 16 takes out the language. Feasibility study.
Thank you.
Sections 30 and 40 are actually related.
Can we stop here and let the employment people that want to testify at this section?
I guess.
Well,
okay.
Now we're going to run out of time, and if we don't...
It'll be fine.
Section 30 is very critical to them, so if they're here to testify...
I'm fine to let them...
Yeah.
I'll yield the mic.
All right. Well, that would be...
Pleasure of the committee.
Thank you.
Such a relief.
It's Graham. Mm-hmm. Graham Slater and David Sparks, you want to come up together? Thank you. Thank you for indulging with us, trying to get through this complicated bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I'm going first. And thank you very much for shuffling some things around here. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I'm the Employment Department's Administrator for Workforce and Economic Research. I think you're going to get two documents. One is just a copy of my brief testimony, and I will just highlight it. Okay. And then a second one just shows you how the Amendment-1 kind of fits in the flow of the statute, as opposed to having to read it. A little bit out of context. Very briefly, the Employment Department, as you probably know, for our various statistical surveys and administrative records, we collect a lot of information from employers in the state, and all of that information is confidential. We don't share it with the public, we don't share it with competitors, we don't share it basically with anyone. But over the years, a number of statute, or our statute, has had a number of changes, 657, which allows certain state agencies to get certain pieces of information from us so that they can do their job. They still keep it confidential, but otherwise they'd be getting it from businesses, and obviously that's not good for the businesses. There are a number of agencies, including the Department of Consumer and Business Services, that have those kind of exceptions. And in the Section 43 to the bill that you're hearing today, the Economic Development Department is also requesting to have that kind of an exception so that we can share some of our confidential information with them for particular purposes, very kind of tightly controlled, and they would still stick to all of the confidentiality restrictions that we place on ourselves. And so the first part of my testimony, and I know that Mike hasn't got to that section yet, but when he does get there, the first part of my testimony is simply to say that we've worked with them on that language, we totally understand their need for it, and we support it. This has been something actually for 3 or 4 years that's been a problem between us, and we're glad to be bringing that to a conclusion. Now, the Dash 1 is a friendly amendment, and what we're trying to do there is to just tidy up a couple of inconsistencies in the existing statute that actually pertain to any state agencies or any government agencies. The first one of those, and if you look at this shaded kind of document that I shared with you, you can see it's on the front page in the dark shading. What we're trying to accomplish there is that on the current statute, we have been told that we can share this information with state and local government agencies, but not with federal agencies. And as you can imagine, there are a number of cases in the workforce arena, in the labor, job training arenas, and then you can go on out into things like economic development, where federal agencies play a pretty critical role in working with us. And so we would like to just clean that up and say, no, we think it's perfectly legitimate to share with a federal agency as well as a state or local agency. Again, everything stays confidential. They can just use it for certain particular purposes. The number two on my testimony here explains what those purposes are. Some years ago, we were permitted to start sharing that information only for the purposes of governmental planning. All we're asking to do is to expand that to say any kind of legitimate research. It could be policy analysis. It could be performance measurement. This is not about people using it for surveys or to bombard employers with information requests. This is just saying expand that planning a little bit, because what we find is that we're caught often in this difficult situation where if someone uses just the right words on their application, we say yes because it's planning. If they wanted to do almost the identical project, but they were, for example, analyzing the historical performance of their programs, we would have to say no. And yet, if they just simply say we're analyzing the historical performance so that we can better plan for the future, then we say yes. And that kind of arbitrariness of the planning thing doesn't make a lot of sense to us. A lot of the players that we work with understand the statute as it is very well, but it does feel kind of inefficient and duplicative for us to say to them, you cannot have it for this very good purpose, but as long as it's planning, you can have it. So we're just asking to expand that for good, reliable research kind of purposes, policy analysis, program analysis, and so on. And then the third one is that we would like to be able to share the industry code. Every company in Oregon has an industry code assigned to it by the Employment Department. We just want to share that with any other government agency that wants it. And the particular reason why that one's important right now is that all of the industry coding structure in the United States is changing, literally January of this year. And so we've been paid by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, federal dollars, to recode every company in Oregon. But our friends at the City of Portland is one example, DCBS is another. They would have to have their own staff repeat all that work, all that training, and that's a huge, obviously, duplication, waste of resources. We've got the data. We can share it with them probably in minutes electronically if we're allowed to by statute. And so that's what we'd like to do here. A brief comment on Amendment -3, which is what DCBS is here for, and that is to say that we've worked with them, has to do primarily with that industry code, and particularly with the fact that if they're in a hearing or a court hearing or a court of law where they're a party, they need to be able to use that industry code in that public setting. Normally the industry code would still be confidential, wouldn't be used in a public meeting, but in that very specific case, they need to be able to use that, and we have no objection to that either. So I'll leave it there. It looks like the body language is most of you are nodding, but you understand where we're going. I'd be happy to take questions if you have any.
I just wanted to make a comment, Madam Chair. It's a good thing Mr. Burton relinquished his time to that, because I have here 654 and 656. I was wondering what they wanted to do with OSHA, because there's a lot of provisions within OSHA, including penalties and fines and all this stuff, and I just didn't want to see them branching too far afield.
Right. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, could you just share what the intent of having kept it confidential, why you wouldn't have shared those, or what the federal government, why it wants to protect some of these that we have to expand it?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Gallegos, it is an Oregon statute that limits the confidentiality, and it just goes back to the earliest days saying that when employers share information with us, they expect us, they want us to keep it confidential. It really comes down to the rub when it could be competitors. We have information about the average wages paid by each company, about the total payroll of each company, and they don't want the person down the road necessarily knowing exactly what they're paying for this occupation. And so for years and years, we've kept this very tight, with the exceptions that are already in the statute. We do, however, as you're probably thinking, think it's time to kind of broaden it a little bit without doing any harm to employers. And that's one of the bottom lines here. Nothing currently confidential becomes not confidential. All we're saying is that it would be good to be able to share it with other governmental entities, but they would not then share it in a more wide way.
Follow up? Sorry, Madam Chair. This is the information age, and if this is not information with respect to a particular individual, their Social Security number, their particular salary, is it reasonable to think why are we having this embargo on some of this information? What is jeopardized? I mean, clearly you want to broaden it to more other agencies, but why do we even have an embargo altogether at this day and age?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I think we're really trying to protect the privacy of the employers. I mean, that is certainly the long-standing goal here. We do know from a survey gathering type of entity, too, that if we don't guarantee confidential information, many of them would not give us the full answers. And so that's a concern to us. We did have earlier discussions within our department about certain things of this. Were they even confidential? Did they have to be confidential at all? And currently, I would not want to come here, at least in this session, feeling that we had support from employers to open this up completely. The industry code, for example, is one we've had a lot of discussions on, whether it should be just not confidential at all. The Attorney General's office advised us that under the current statute, they believe that it is. And we didn't feel that we had the time, because this happened fairly recently, to talk to employer groups. I mean, there's a lot of employer groups who need to be involved if we're suddenly going to say it's no longer confidential. So maybe this is a first step, you know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sparks.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is David Sparks, assistant to the administrator for Oregon OSHA, and RAM really kind of already made a comment relative to my testimony. I won't repeat what I've already distributed, but essentially what we're requesting is that for Section 43 of this Act, that subpart 10 be amended. Currently, it provides that the Employment Department will provide information to the Department of Consumer and Business Services for carrying out the duties of ORS Chapter 656, which is the workers' compensation statute, requesting that we would add language in subpart 10, parent 10, that would also provide that the Employment Department could provide information to not just carry out the duties of ORS 656, but also ORS 654, which is the statute that we administer, the Oregon Safe Employment Act. That really basically is the thrust of the request in the Dash 3 amendment. And as Graham indicated, it goes on to give us the opportunity to share the information in an administrative hearing or a court of law. It divulged that, for example, the industrial classification of an employer that we would be dealing with. But in all other cases, it would remain confidential and honor the statute administered by the Employment Department, and we would not divulge that information otherwise.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sparks? Representative Gallegos, you don't have a question?
I don't. I'm going to save it for another time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity.
You're welcome. Kim needs to. Chair Smith, members of the committee, we've also received from Mark Landauer from the Portland Development Commission some written testimony that's been passed out to you in support of the amendments that were just discussed.
Thank you. We have about 5 minutes left. Maybe we could continue this on Monday. Would that work? Would that work? Okay. Let's do that. We'll Well, you'll have met with them by then. Hopefully we'll have some of those answered. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2300. Further business before the committee, I will adjourn.